It's Ian Pickus, and we are back in the Congressional Corner today with New York Congressman George Latimer, a Democrat from New York's 16th District, and he has been in office just since January. Congressman Latimer, welcome back.
Nice to be with you, Ian.
So, you know, this is our first time speaking since you were sworn in, and it's obviously been a very busy time in Washington. How would you characterize your first few months in the new job?
Chaotic. There's no way to change it. I mean, you have a new administration that's come in, and they have purposefully done as many provocative things as they can. And I think it's part of their philosophy, frankly, to change the whole structure of the federal government. And to do so without any analysis, without any dialogue across the aisle. Now, the Republicans do have control of the House by a handful of votes, but they voted pretty much along party lines on everything. So they have a solid majority, even if it's slim. And in the Senate, their majority is 53-47. It's not enough to withstand a filibuster, but depending on the issue, they've been able to position Senate Democrats in a way that has accomplished most of what they've set out to do. The problem, frankly, is that you have an entity, the federal government, that people look at from afar and say, oh, it's big, it's bloated. There certainly must be waste. There may, in fact, be fraud and corruption. But that's a general sense of things. And this administration, the Trump administration, has moved to capitalize on that with irresponsible cuts all across the board to end USAID, to end the Department of Education, not to reform it, to get rid of Social Security offices, not to sit and analyze how do we downsize and consolidate districts, but just to whack them out wherever you can, creating real difficulty. And I'm not sure that folks feel the impact of these decisions yet, but they will. And when they do on Social Security, on veterans, on Medicaid, and a host of different areas, they're not going to be happy.
Now, you've worked in all levels of government, you know, from local to the state legislature to being an executive in Westchester County. Is there anything about being in the House of Representatives that has surprised you so far?
Well, I mean, I can't deny that there's a sense of history in the chamber. You know, I'm functioning now in a chamber where a few feet away, Franklin Delano Roosevelt gave the Day of Infamy speech after Pearl Harbor was bombed, or where Lyndon Johnson eulogized John Kennedy after his assassination. And this is where I'm working, where I'm on the floor of the House. So you walk through the Capitol at night, and Albany was impressive to me as well when I got there 20 years ago. In the same way, it has magnificence to it, and certainly Washington does as well. So on one level, that feeling is special. You know, I grew up as a blue-collar kid. My dad was a maintenance man. My mom was a factory worker. I grew up in a tough urban section of a portion of my hometown right on the border of the Bronx and Westchester. So on that level of it, it's different. However, what I'm watching, I think, is surprising in that the Republicans have absolute control. They've had it recently before. Donald Trump started out in his first term with control of both houses. George Bush had control of both houses at various times in their career. But this is not just a Republican-Democrat thing. This is a MAGA ideological majority. And whether all the Republican members are going along because they believe it or they're forced to believe it, they're marching in lockstep on issue after issue after issue. And it does surprise me that the deliberation, the deliberative process that I hoped was going to be found here, I don't find. I find we have the votes and we're going to change America. And here it comes.
I'm going to ask you about a lot of issues in our time together, but just one more thing about settling into Washington. A lot of people on this show, especially folks who have been there for a while, I'm thinking of particularly Richie Neal from the 1st District in Massachusetts, who got there at the end of the 80s. They lament the fact that kind of the mingling part of the job doesn't exist anymore. And, you know, people could slap each other on the back after a day of debate and that kind of thing. And instead, they spend a lot of time kind of fundraising and getting back to the district. Are you finding that that's true of Congress today?
Well, I think the fundraising dynamic is a disgrace, and I've had to do it, and you do it because it's a matter of survival. But much more so in this job than any other legislative job I've had. I mean, my earlier years, you know, county legislator, city council didn't involve it. A certain amount when I served in the state legislature, particularly when I was a targeted state senator. I was in the minority in those days, and I had to work at fundraising. But down here, it's a cottage industry. And it does take away time from legislating. What's also happening, I think, down here is that you have a much more sharper ideological edge between the two parties. And I can't comment as to when it happened because I just got here. But it's clear to me that that ideological edge makes it very hard to develop friendships across the aisle. And when I was in the state Senate and the state assembly, I had friends that I disagreed with that served in those two bodies and the other party, some in my own party, but we maintained a friendly enough relationship. I can remember any number of times going out to dinner with Brian Cole when he was the minority leader of the state assembly. And we'd have, you know, a friendly joust, and we'd have our agreements, we'd have our disagreements. But down here, that seems to be less the case. And I guess there was a day when it was not the rule, but it seems to be the rule now to the greater extent. There are individuals on the other side of the aisle, particularly those that I served with in the state legislature, who I have a good relationship with. I work with Mike Lawler, Andy Garbarino, Nick LaLota was a staffer in the Senate when I was there. He worked for Phil Boyle and Nicole Malliotakis, Claudia Tenney. So those are people I know from my past experience. We may disagree on issues, but the vast majority of the chamber seems to be disconnected by the party line, that you really socialize in one corridor of people or the other.
As best I can tell, you and Representative Lawler are working together on the issue of access to Social Security offices in the Lower Hudson Valley. In fact, Westchester County offered some space for the SSA to keep an office open, which I gather was rejected. So what's the update for listeners who are wondering where they will go or will have to go?
I think the Social Security Administration under the Trump administration has determined that they're going to close offices nationwide, period. It's going to be harder for people to appeal cases of Social Security. And if they can make the distance far enough and inconvenient enough, you may not even pursue the appeal. So you're denied benefits or your benefits are reduced arbitrarily. And if you don't go to appeal and go back a couple of times to do the appeal, you lose heart. And, you know, the other side gets to cut Social Security without saying they cut Social Security, because that's a big thing here. People know that Social Security is a popular program. The Trump administration doesn't want to be seen as cutting Social Security. But if they cut the office in White Plains and they force some people in New Rochelle to go to New Haven, Connecticut, or a person from Middletown in Orange County or Monticello have to go into New York City rather than White Plains, which is a more convenient site for them, then they've cut Social Security without having to say they've cut it, and they win the political argument. Westchester County, County Executive Ken Jenkins, who was my deputy when I was county executive, graciously found space available that was less expensive than the private sector space we were renting. The Social Security Administration didn't want to hear it, weren't interested. So this isn't a decision made about how do we reduce spending but still serve the public. This is an ideological decision to make it harder for people to get Social Security. And I think it's only the canary in the tunnel. There are hundreds of issues like this. This is the ideology of the second Trump administration, and they intend to change America. There's no question about it. The question is, do we feel strong enough to push back against it?
And we just have about a minute left in today's segment, but you actually broke the news to me about the death of former Congresswoman Nita Lowey at age 87. And I wanted to give you a minute to talk about her life and legacy. Did she teach you anything helpful about the job you have now?
She taught me so much that I can't even begin to tell you in a few seconds. Nita Lowey did her job, and there's sort of a dichotomy to these jobs, and she did them both brilliantly well. In Washington, she served 32 years. She rose to the head of the Appropriations Committee. She was well-respected by her colleagues. When the news broke and I was here and I had the chance to talk to people, they were all heartbroken to a person. She showed leadership. She was a leader in the defense of PBS. She was a leader in defense of women's health and programs for the environment, just across the board. Back home in Westchester County, she was the congresswoman who showed up everywhere all the time, and she was warm. You know, she was like your mom. She'd put her arms around you and she'd greet people. And there wasn't any hint that she was as powerful a congresswoman as she was. She had none of that ego that surrounded her. And she was a very successful woman. She and her husband raised children and had a good life in a lot of different ways. And she was the exemplar. What I've said is she had very small feet. She has very big shoes to fill, and I don't think I can fill those shoes. We do the best we can.
You said something about the way the Democrats should be approaching this moment, and I just wanted to get your opinion about Senator Schumer, He's facing a lot of criticism right now, the minority leader in the other chamber, about his decision ultimately to approve the House Republican government funding bill. So what did you think of that decision? And do you think there's any merit to the criticism that it might be time for him to step aside?
I don't think there's any merit in the criticism. I think this is a strategic decision that Senator Schumer made, and he has access to information that I don't have in running the Senate. He no doubt surveyed his members. Maybe he knew that he didn't have enough members to break cloture, and that's why he did the things he did. I think if there was a mistake by any of us, and I'll include all of us in it, we should have immediately offered an alternative amendment that would have reduced some of the worst parts of the continuing resolution, something that would have protected Social Security, Veterans Administration, maybe Medicaid, knowing that there were other parts of the continuing resolution that were abhorrent, but the likelihood that it would go through at the end of the day was there. We didn't do that. The royal we did not do that. And I do understand that if there was a shutdown, even for 24 hours, that President Trump would use that extra authority that would come to him in a shutdown to do his work even more aggressively to demolish these things. The real problem that we face isn't the decision of whether to filibuster or not. It is going after the core decision making by the Trump administration and those Republicans that back him up that decimate Social Security, decimate Veterans Administration support, proposes to impose tariffs on Canada and our European allies that will be crippling, abandons Ukraine and to make common cause with Russia in the United Nations, issue after issue after issue. That's the core element. And it becomes a sideshow for Democrats to start arguing with each other or speculating who's going to run for senator, who's going to run for president. We've got a battle right now that requires a unified, logical front. And it doesn't mean that we accept waste in the department. It does mean that we show a business-like analysis of how do we identify and reduce the waste rather than this meat axe approach to things. If I'm overweight, I don't cut off my arm to lose poundage. I go on a diet and I modify my intake and I exercise. That's how you do it. And that's how you root out waste, and to the extent that you can assert that there is fraud or corruption. I don't believe it's wrought with fraud and corruption. I think that's a political assertion. Those are the challenges right now, not necessarily who's going to run for what position in the next few years.
You are on the House Foreign Affairs Committee. What was your reaction to the story about the text chain involving Inner Circle, top administration officials, and as we learned, accidentally, the editor of The Atlantic?
Well, I mean, it's an embarrassment, but it's also a breach that causes you to question competence. Now, you know, when Donald Trump ran for president, it was implicit in his appeal that he had been president already. He had 4 years in the presidency, so you don't expect a rookie mistake to come out of his administration, and that's what this is. To have somebody who shouldn't be on an encrypted circle and have access to information, this could have been a Chinese agent or a Russian agent who could have done great damage to the United States. We might have dead pilots or a sunken boat in the Red Sea had this gone to the wrong person rather than to, in this particular case, a reporter for the Atlantic publication. But what's also implicit is who do you surround yourself with? And while I think some of his appointments, Marco Rubio, Waltz, there's a few of them that I think are capable people. I might disagree with their philosophy. There's a lot of people who are in these positions who, frankly, don't have the experience or the knowledge necessary to hold those positions. And in his first administration, he had a number of people who you could argue were credentialed for their positions, but they also pushed back on him. And they didn't want him to do all the things he wanted to do. So I think in the second administration, he's prioritized loyalty to him above everything else. And so you get a Bobby Kennedy heading Health and Human Services, who I don't think is qualified. I know Bob Kennedy, he's not qualified for that position. You have a Pete Hegseth, who is questionable. Tulsi Gabbard, questionable. But these folks have given undying loyalty to Trump. So now you have some inexperience, I'll argue, in management at this level, and this kind of a breach, I think, reflects some of that. Now, the question is, if you present to people, trust me, we're going to impose tariffs, and it's going to work out. I'm believing in your competence if I believe you. I don't believe that, but if somebody does, they're believing in your competence. You see something like this is that is incompetent, and it undermines your argument. trust me, tariffs will work out fine. They won't work out fine because you're showing a lack of basic follow-through and detailed attention to detail that's necessary.
Well, what should happen? I mean, I think it's fair to say Republicans, especially in the House, are not interested in challenging the administration to this point. So, I mean, there are calls for hearings. Do you think there will be any consequences for this breach?
Well, I don't think the Republicans in the House or the Senate are going to upset Donald Trump by holding hearings. I remember when they were all ready to hold all kinds of hearings when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State. They thought that it was
perfectly fine.
Yes, they thought it was perfectly fine to roast a member of the other party when they had the opportunity to do it. But here's the problem. You know, Donald Trump has become so popular with the GOP base that every congressman fears him coming into their district and endorsing a MAGA primary opponent against him. And then Elon Musk has said, this isn't guesswork, he said he will fund the primary of people who oppose any Republican that doesn't stay on the plan. So the American model was based on separation of powers and a three-branch system of government that's a check and a balance on each other. George Washington himself did not want a king, and he could have been a king. And that check and balance is what's kept us a free democracy all these years. You've broken that barrier down now by who you've appointed to the Supreme Court, and you've broken that barrier down now by having so much control in your own party that you can tell independently elected legislators, you're not an independent legislator, you'll do what I tell you to do. And that is bad for democracy. And the policies that are going to come out of it aren't going to be questioned. They're not going to be challenged. One man sitting in the Oval Office is going to make decisions. And if he makes the wrong decision, we're all going to suffer from it.
Early in the Congress, and I've been asking all of our guests this question because it was put forward as an early bill to kind of litmus test people, I think. But anyway, you voted no on the Laken Riley Act, which I think was H.R. 2. How come?
Bad bill. The bill codified things that were already into law relative to the terrible tragedy that happened to Laken Riley. She was murdered by an individual. That individual happened to be an undocumented alien. And there were existing laws to prosecute that person. But what the law goes on to do is broaden what would be a person's behavior, projecting that they would be the next person to commit a violent crime. That's a presumption that you could apply to anybody who is drunk and disorderly, anybody who jaywalks, anybody who has a traffic infraction, not just a person who's an alien. You're opening the door to preemptive incarceration of people, in this case, deportation. That's a terrible standard to have. So the bill was a lousy bill. It was poorly written. It was emotional because you went to the story of Laken Riley and she died. And then, if you vote no, you don't see the tragedy of Laken Riley's death. We had a death in Westchester County. A man killed his live-in lover, and he was an illegal immigrant. And I said at the time that he should be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law, and that's what's happening right now. So the story of Laken Riley is not preemptively, let's round up everybody because one of them might commit a crime, but it's that you have severe penalties that apply whether you are a documented or an undocumented alien. But they use that as a way to broaden the deportation powers because that's really what they want to do. And we all agree that you should identify criminals, gang members, and deport those individuals. There's no ambiguity about that. But that's not what the Trump administration wants to do. The Trump administration wants to go into every kitchen where there is a person washing dishes. They want to go in every field where somebody is helping harvest the crop in upstate New York and find every single one of these persons and send them back to some home country, no matter how long they've been here. And if their kids were born here, he'd like to override birthright citizenship and said, well, you might have been born in America, but that's a special category. You get deported too. This is not America. This is not the intelligent way to deal with our immigration problem. And Laken Riley was one example of that.
Congressman Latimer, we were talking about your role on the House Foreign Affairs Committee. You're also on small business, and you've gotten a bill advanced already, the Transparency and Predictability in Small Business Opportunities Act. What does it do?
Well, what the bill does is requires the federal government to communicate with those small businesses that are bidding for contracts in the federal government and to give them the kind of information and transparency that they can then make decisions of whether or not they're going to spend the money necessary to prepare a bid, usually a complicated bid, usually an expensive bid. The smaller the company, the more they're putting money out discretionarily at some risk in order to have the hope of picking up the federal contract. And then when the federal government decides, a department decides for whatever reason to cancel that contract, they put that small business at a terrible disadvantage. This bill tries to correct that. By the way, the agency that's putting the program out to bid interacts with those that are bidding for it and gives them an opportunity to bid in the future if they decide not to do a particular program. It's a small fix for a problem that exists. I'm fortunate to have Republican sponsor on it as well, Mark Alford, from the state of Missouri, and this bill has gotten through the Small Business Committee. It's a good bill for what it does, and I'm pleased that we found an area where bipartisanship could apply.
Are you pretty happy with your committee assignments? I remember you had kind of tabbed these two when we talked before they were announced.
I did, but you know, I've been around. I was a freshman in the assembly once. I was a freshman in the county legislature. I was a freshman in the New York Senate. The fact that I have all this experience now and I'm not a young man doesn't mean I get any extra special privileges as a freshman. So I asked for some committees. I was happy with the ones I got. I'm trying to work hard in both of them. Foreign affairs, of course, is fascinating. And there, I had no governmental foreign affairs experience prior to coming to this. So this is sort of like going to college and learning something that you didn't study in high school. At the same token, small business is something we focused on in Westchester and during my tenure in the state legislature. So I'm happy to have one area where I have some experience and can contribute in another one where it's a growth factor.
Did you get any advice from Elliot Engel about foreign affairs?
Well, I did. And I had the pleasure of talking to both Nita Lowey before she passed away and Elliot Engel. And then also Richard Ottinger, who's a longtime congressman. He's been out of office now a good number of years, but he's still with us. And he was a prominent congressman in my younger years. All three of them gave me excellent advice, not just about the committee structure, but how the House works. Some of them rooted in a different era of Congress. It's different now than it was when they were in Congress. But I valued that from them. And, as I think I've said before, it's going to take a long time before I can make any kind of a contribution in Congress that equals what Elliot Engel, Nita Lowey, or Dick Ottinger has done. They all had tremendous careers. At best, I hope to be a worthy successor for the time that I'm here.
What's your read on what will happen with congestion pricing? Obviously, an important issue for your district. The administration and New York State are at odds, but it's been delayed another 30 days.
Well, it really comes down to a legal decision, and I'm not, capable of knowing how that's going to turn out. If the courts determine that President Trump's rescission of President Biden's authority to go forward is accurate, if he can, in fact, rescind that approval and that kills it, then it's going to die. I'm not sure what motivates the president in this particular case. Congestion pricing, we've talked about this before, a very controversial issue. I probably have about half the people that want it, half the people that don't want it. And every time it comes up, I always ask the very simple question. If we don't use congestion pricing as a tool, let's say we agree we don't want to do this as a mechanism to raise money, how do we fund the legitimate needs of the MTA? Will somebody give me a legitimate alternate plan? If the federal government is going to pull congestion pricing, but turn around and grant the MTA significant money to do the capital improvements that are needed, that might be an answer, but I don't hear the Trump administration looking to do that. I've heard some people say, well, we have to go after fare beaters. Fare beaters, if you fully solve that problem, might amount to about $700 million. The gap is $15 billion. There's a big gap between those two things. And that's where, Ian, having been a county executive, helps me. When you're a legislator, you don't really worry about how all the numbers line up. I spent 7 years trying to make sure the budget's lined up in Westchester County, $2.5 billion budget. And you don't worry about soft math here. You have to have hard math that connects the dots. In this case, the MTA needs to make improvements that are significant in the system. And if it ain't congestion pricing, then you need to identify what is the path that money's going to come from. But if he winds up having the power to kill congestion pricing, this is the power you grant a president of the United States. He won by a couple percentage points. He legitimately won. He did not win a landslide. But now it's his presidency, and this is how he chooses to use it.
What do you think the impacts of dismantling the Department of Education would be on the 16th District?
Add it to the list of foolish decisions. It's going to cost White Plains School District money. It's going to cost New Rochelle and even Rye and Pelham get money from the Department of Education. Certainly the city of New York benefits greatly from this. The Department of Education has a value in backing up what is still primarily a local decision made in the state of New York through the Board of Regents and in the local school districts through the local school boards. But the federal government has played a positive role in this area. And once again, I think what I'm watching is the destruction of government by people, Elon Musk and his merry band of 20-year-olds, who don't understand and thereby devalue what government is. In their world, they don't deal with government very much. They think government is an impediment for them to do the things they want to do. And so they want to deconstruct it. And they don't look at the school children in impoverished neighborhoods like the one I grew up in Mount Vernon that will have a more difficult time if the Department of Education and its funding of the various title programs disappear. In the same way that their lives will be made difficult when you reduce SNAP financing for solving hunger or dealing with hunger. In the same way that it happens when you cut back aid across the board, you know, USAID, the foreign aid that we provide, people say, well, why are we giving that money? No one realizes New York State farmers and other farmers around the country sell their product to USAID. Now that's not happening. They have product that's going to rot in the barn because they don't have a buyer for their product. All of these ramifications were never considered in the Department of Education and in the other actions. And this is not the end of it. I expect them to go after the Department of Labor. I expect them to go after anything that they think in their minds is not ideological simpatico with the MAGA America that they believe in. And that MAGA America was not Ronald Reagan's America. Let's be clear. Ronald Reagan said, don't impose tariffs on your neighbor. Ronald Reagan called Russia the evil empire. This is not Ronald Reagan's presidency here. This is not George H.W. Bush's presidency. And therefore, you know, Republicans who were successful in the nation in their day. This is a whole nother thing. And it intends to change America right on the cusp of our 250th birthday into something that it has never been before. You're going against things that Washington and Roosevelt and Lincoln stood for, and you're doing it in record time, 2 months, 2.5 months.
I just have a couple of minutes left. I always love talking New York State politics with you. So I got a couple on Empire State goings on. First of all, I just wonder, you know, it looks like if we can trust the polls that former Governor Cuomo might be the next mayor of New York City. What do you think about that?
Well, you know, first of all, I've learned, and sometimes the hard way, Ian, that as much as you look at a poll, it's a snapshot of the moment. And things can change. I've been in races where I was behind this close. I mean, he's, I guess the primary is in June and we're talking here in late March. There's a couple of months until the primary. I've been in races where the poll showed me behind and then it wound up okay. And then of course the reverse where you didn't do as well as the poll said you would. Also, New York has ranked voting. I don't know how to calculate that because you could finish number one on people's ballots, but the number two candidate gets everybody else's third, fourth, and fifth vote. And then when ranked voting is finished, the number two guy wins. So with those provisos, look, I think Andrew Cuomo is a strong personality. He certainly can point to accomplishments that he had as governor. He had difficulties as well. No one can deny that. But he had accomplishments, the bridge over the Hudson River, the improvements of the various airports. You know, I voted for the raise in minimum wage, which he authored. I voted for marriage equality, which he authored. I voted for the ban on which he sponsored. So he has a record to run on. New York City's management is a complicated situation. And he comes to the table arguing that he has the requisite experience in managing something big, such as the state of New York. So I think that makes him a very formidable candidate. But how it all plays out amongst the field of players, I know a number of them personally. Scott Stringer and I served together in the state assembly. I have great respect for him. I've seen the work that other state legislators have done. It's still not a done deal until you go through the next 90 days.
Okay, lastly, were you surprised by Antonio Delgado's decision to not seek re-election as lieutenant governor next year? And second part of that question, do you think he actually would have a chance to beat Governor Hochul in a primary?
It's a strange thing, Ian, and I thought about this a lot during my tenure as county executive. I asked, you don't run for re-election. You don't run for election to be a deputy county executive. The county executive appoints you. So I asked Ken Jenkins to be deputy county executive. He and I competed in a primary head-to-head. I won the primary. I wound up winning the election. I asked him to be number two, which surprised a lot of people. I don't think it made news in New York State. It made news in Westchester County. And Ken and I think you saw this, we worked together in a visibly close way when we had our weekly updates, Ken was there. There's certain topics Ken handled himself, and he showed that he had the mettle and the ability. I move on to Congress, and Ken becomes the county executive. He gets elected in the special election. He's got a very good chance to win in November. He and I worked closely as a team. I have watched gubernatorial lieutenant governor teams, president, vice presidential teams, and I've wondered what happens. Why isn't it closer? Somebody picked somebody to be a running mate, and then a couple of years later, they're not on good terms with each other. So I can't speak to the internal situation. I have great respect for the governor, great respect for the lieutenant governor. How they fell out, what was the basis for it, I can't tell you. I do know that there are any number of people that are looking at running for governor. I listen to your broadcasts, and you have different people on who are interested in being governor. And, you know, I suppose I can't remember when there wasn't a primary for the New York nomination for governor. So I suppose there'll be another one again. But I take some comfort from my primary against Ken Jenkins 8 years. You're competing, but you should not oppose each other. We should find the fact that, yes, we're Democrats, we're common ground. The winner is going to be the winner, and I support the winner. I hope it's me, but I'm not going to denigrate the loser. And that's the way, if we go into that that battle, whatever the battle is, whoever's engaged in that battle, as Democrats, we have the best possible chance to retain the governorship. I assure you, if we get a MAGA governor with the power they have to write the budget language, we will have a very different state of New York. And that's what some people want. They want a New York state that's going to change as dramatically as the federal government has changed. I don't want that. I want New York to improve and reform certain things, but I don't want it to turn into a MAGA version of what I'm seeing from Trump White House.
Let me get you in trouble. Is Mike Lawler a MAGA governor? Should he win?
You know, I work with Mike, and we have common ground where we have common ground, and where we disagree, we disagree. It's for Mike to make his case to the Republican Party. I gather Bruce Blakeman is interested in doing it too, from everything I can tell from afar. I don't know if there's anybody else in that picture. So in round one, that's what Mike has to worry about, what he's doing in the Republican Party to get the nomination. And if he is the Republican nominee, who our Democratic nominee is, if it's the governor again or some other person, then at that point in time, Ian, I'm sure I'll be on your program. And I'll be more than happy to give you my, one man's opinion.
We've been speaking with New York Congressman George Latimer, a Democrat from the 16th District. He's been around for a while, but he's in his first term in Congress. Congressman Latimer, we really appreciate all of your time, and we look forward to the next round.
It's good to talk to you, Ian.